On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Apple fears the root, Tesla powers up down under, Microsoft goes on a building spree, and the CEO of OmniNet stops by to explain why your next firewall will be in the cloud. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 267, recorded December 1st, 2017. Firewalls as a Service. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It helps you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And by Hover. Register a domain name with Hover and build your online brand today. Go to hover.com/twit and save 10% off your first purchase. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professionals, the IT pros, and the geeks who just want to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. It's an awfully big enterprise world. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, from my experts, and specifically from Mr. Lou Maresca. He is, well, Lou, what do we call you now? I mean, you've been the booth babe extreme. You've been a senior lead. You've been engineer extraordinaire. What should we call you now?
You know, you can call me Debug Dog. How about that?
We've got Debug Dog from the dog. Redmond campus.
Yeah, that's it.
I've noticed, wait a minute. Wait, go back to that picture, Kevin. That's not the office you've been in, nor is it the office that you were.
Right? They all look the same, right?
What's going on, man?
You know, you probably heard we're making some changes around here, knocking some things down and building some things up. And there's been a bunch of shifting and sharing of offices. And this is just my new digs for a while. It's actually great. I wish I could show you, but I have a beautiful view of an evergreen forest behind me here.
A real evergreen forest, or is it a mixed reality?
A real evergreen forest. I'll show you later. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll go with that. Now, Chibert's not with us this week because he is currently on a boat. It's a well-deserved month-long cruise with him, his wife, and Curtis Franklin and his wife. So we wish them well. We'll hopefully check in with them for once in a while. I don't think Chibert can stay away. He's kind of addicted to the Twit Army. Well, Lou, it's just you and I for now. What do you say we go ahead and kick it off? Because this is going to be one heck of a show. Not only are we going to be covering the news, not only are we doing some deep diving into some ISPs behaving badly, but we've got one heck of a guest who's going to explain a few things about the state of unified threat management. You want to kick this thing off?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's start it off with something that comes from the, yes, you've definitely heard about it, but it's important enough that we do need to cover it file. And that is that Apple had a bad week. Yes, we know this. And not that normal stocks will do what stocks do week, but in an exceedingly rare, did you guys even test this thing way? This past Tuesday, it was publicly disclosed that Apple's latest Mac OS update, High Sierra, contained what we thought was a bug, namely that typing root into the user field and clicking login a few times would eventually allow anybody with local or remote connectivity to access the OS as, you guessed it, root. Apple moved quickly with a patch, and new updates will get a version of High Sierra that isn't vulnerable to the same bug. However, if you have any Macs in your enterprise that spent any time with the vulnerability, that means you now need to consider those machines untrustworthy. Best practices would be to wipe and reinstall such machines. So, admins, get to it.
Microsoft is not stopping at modernizing just their products and marketing. They thought it's time that they take some of their original locations as part of their cement jungle in Redmond to the next level. You heard about the Treehouse conference rooms. Well, this is just the next step. With 47,000 workers in the Washington state area, they thought, why not add 8,000 more? The newly renovated headquarters will knock down 12 low-rise buildings at the heart of the company's original headquarters and replace them with 18 new buildings, many of them double the height. The square footage will be equal to about 180 football fields. There is also a focus on more open and collaborative environment with fewer employees sequestered in closed offices. The new design also features a community space for 8,000 to 12,000 people in an open-air plaza and outdoor areas including running and walking trails, sport facilities, and green spaces. It might not be a spaceship on campus, but it's trying to bring the community to the workplace.
Wi-Fi has been around long enough that most of us have chosen at one point or another a humorous SSID. Here at the Twit studio, within range of my laptop, I've got FBI surveillance fan, don't panic, and a von Neumann probe. But perhaps it might be wise to leave your wireless sense of humor at home when traveling. That's what a group of passengers discovered when their Turkish Airlines flight from Nairobi to Istanbul was instead diverted to Khartoum in Sudan after a passenger started up a Wi-Fi hotspot with the SSID bomb on board. All 100 passengers were removed from the plane, then reloaded hours later after security checks were performed. Now, there's no word on if the authorities were able to identify who owned the poorly named hotspot, but let's hope that our listeners have a bit more sense.
The future of quantum physics is coming into focus. Quantum simulators are a special type of quantum computer that uses qubits to simulate complex interactions between particles. Qubits, which are actually in quantum computing, are particles that can be multiple states at once rather than their standard transistors used today, which are either one or zero. To date, researchers were only able to create a quantum simulator consisting of a few dozen qubits, while researchers at the University of Maryland and National Institute of Standards and Technology can now create a quantum simulator with 53 qubits. This is something out of a sci-fi film. These qubits are made from ions and are strung together in rows like pearls on a laser necklace. In the quantum simulator, lasers are used to manipulate the qubits in a vacuum changer to simulate quantum interactions between the particles in the case and quantum magnetism. These new simulators can analyze models over a quadrillion different magnetic configurations of qubits, a number that doubles each additional qubit added to the array. Why is this so exciting? Well, these simulators are close to being able to model physics that are too complex even for the most powerful conventional supercomputers of today. The future is here, to infinity and beyond.
Now, data centers, at least the truly gigantic ones, tend to have a few commonalities. Super high power use, super high density, and an above average turnover for technologies that allow for more efficiency in those categories. So perhaps it shouldn't be surprising that a data center might be the nexus for a practical next-gen power unit. Microsoft and Daimler, that's right, Daimler, the car manufacturer, have announced that they are partnering to create a hydrogen fuel cell to power Redmond's data centers. Daimler has been working on fuel cells for years, with its current generation technology being 40% more power dense and 30% smaller than the previous generation. Microsoft has already announced their intention to install a 10-megawatt fuel cell at one of their data centers, so this partnership seems like a very good step to fulfill that promise. While hydrogen fuel cells will continue to be more costly than grid tie-in and internal combustion engine backups, Microsoft is hoping to leverage their advantages, primarily their extremely low maintenance, carbon neutrality, and instant power capabilities, in the creation of data center-focused microgrids that provide more options for power generation and are far more stable than grid tie-ins.
Recently, the Spanish Data Protection Commission fined Google 300,000 euros for unlawfully processing user data gathered through its streets viewing mapping service. And the European Commission levied a 2.4 billion euro antitrust penalty on the search giant in June for skewing results to thwart smaller shopping search services. Apple's iPhone's default privacy settings are pretty much known to most users. A group called Google You Owe Us is adding to the fire by claiming people's personal info and data is unlawfully bypassed by bypassing the iPhone's default privacy settings. Google's backdoor method of installing cookies on iPhones, despite them being blocked in Safari settings, was discovered in 2012 by a Stanford researcher, Jonathan Mayer, who discovered that although mobile Safari's default settings blocks cookies from third parties and advertisers, Google and advertising companies Media Innovation Group and Vibrant Media and Gannett fooled mobile Safari into thinking a person was submitting an invisible form to Google, letting them in turn install a tracking cookie on users, iPhones and PCs. So the U.S. Federal Trade Commission fined Google $22.5 million for violating their user privacy later that same year. Well, the Google You Owe Me group is not letting go. If the suit is won in the UK for users, users could actually receive as much as £500 or $672 each from Google as a compensation for the search giant bypassing their security privacy settings. This is showing a trend of organizations and people as they're trying to hold the big dogs accountable for privacy in hopes it sends a message into the industry that they should do something too. One hopes it strikes a bit of fear into some of the smaller companies and startups when it comes to new technology and security.
Now, back in July, we reported on Tesla's successful bid for a 129 megawatt hour battery system for South Australia. The bid had been solicited by the Australian government as a solution for a string of blackouts that had increasingly disrupted the power grid for almost 2 years beforehand. At the time, it was a politically charged contract, with detractors deriding Tesla as a, quote, Hollywood solution, unquote, in a country that is still mostly dependent on coal. Supporters pointed out that Tesla's battery wouldn't replace fossil fuels, but instead would even out the power grid by more efficiently using the large wind farm generated energy that can account for as much as 40% and as little as 5% of the country's energy needs, depending on the wind. To ease concerns, Tesla promised that they could build the facility within 100 days or it would be free. Well, they made their date, and Australia is now the proud owners of the world's largest lithium-ion battery array. The Tesla country-scale Powerwall is just a part of the $385 million plan to shore up the electrical grid, with tech ranging from the lithium-ion battery to a series of diesel-fueled turbines. However, the world will most likely be focusing on the Tesla battery as larger nations look at ways to patch their increasingly unstable national power grids. In any case, stay tabbed. That does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites. And yeah, folks, I'm sorry. I know some of you are sick of this, but we're going to have to dive a little bit back into net neutrality. But it's not the angle you think it is. Before we get there, though, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you like going to the bank to apply for a loan or a mortgage? Of course you don't. It's a horrible experience. It's one that really hasn't kept up with the internet age. Imagine dragging a banker's box or several banker's box filled with old receipts and pay stubs to try to convince some rando that you are a good risk, that you deserve to get a loan because of your next idea, your next big business, your next big thing. Well, folks, you could keep doing that. You could do a process that dates back to the last millennium, or you could get with the times. And that's exactly what Quicken Loans did with Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans is the best, the easiest way to apply for a mortgage in the new generation. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. And that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Now, it's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. No cookie cutter mortgages. It's also convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. I mean, sharing your financial details should be as simple as putting a post on Facebook. That's what Rocket Mortgage understood. And so they will securely transmit your details at the click of a button. It's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And with those calculations, based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it. Lou, I know I did a double take and then a triple take and then a quadruple take because I really didn't want to cover a net neutrality story. But dang it, this is a big story and it does need to be covered. Now, Charter is already trying to abuse the loss of net neutrality regulations, even though those regulations aren't yet gone. Now, remember way back when ISPs super duper pinky swear promised that they'd be good on their own without any regulations required? And remember when they supported Ajit Pai's rollback of net neutrality regulations because they're already super consumer friendly and all about honesty and fairness? And remember when anti-net neutrality supporters asked what was the worst that could happen if we removed the super bad Obama era protections? Well, I think the only response is Lol. This past Monday, Charter Communications filed for the dismissal of a New York State lawsuit against Charter-owned Time Warner Cable over deceptive practices. Now, the lawsuit filed this past February alleged that TWC deceived the FCC to receive a better internet speed score, which they then used in their advertising to claim 100, 200, and 300 megabits per second service, when in actuality, they knew the network was unable to deliver that. In fact, at most times, it was up to 80% slower than what was paid for. Well, even though the net neutrality regulations haven't yet been repealed, Charter is already trying to use the lack of those regulations to their advantage. In their filing for dismissal, Charter claims that PI's rollback of net neutrality, which will include a preemption of states' rights to corrective actions over ISPs, means that the state of New York doesn't have the power to hold them accountable for their deceptive practices. This is just the start of ISPs behaving badly, but it is worthy of note. Because if an ISP will so cavalierly pronounce that they're not accountable to their customers, the state attorney general, nor any federal regulations, and the ink isn't even dry on the repeal, how much worse will it get when it becomes law? Now, Lou, I want to throw this over to you before we dive much further into it, because I want to say I'm shocked. I want to say I'm surprised, but this is not the face of shock. This is not the face of surprise. This is the face of, yeah, that totally makes sense. What's your take?
This may contain peanuts, right? I mean, there's like, it's that kind of thing, as they're saying, you know, we should be allowed to do this because we can't guarantee things all the time, everywhere, depending on environment and all this stuff. And, you know, it makes sense, but when you're 80% slower than what you claim, there, it's just, you got to shake your head. So I'm not surprised.
Right. We've got JJ to the 484 in the chat room, and he's making an honest effort to give us the other side of the argumentation. And the other side is, as presented by the FCC and Ajit Pai, that the FTC should have this. It's not the FCC's place, and it's not the state's place, but the FTC. Here's the thing. The FTC actually did have authority over these issues for many, many decades before the FCC actually took control. Do you know how many times an ISP was prosecuted? Zero. And now the FTC budget is 30% less than it was before the era of net neutrality. Do you know how many prosecutions there's going to be after? That's right, less than zero. They know that the FTC does not have the manpower to go after ISPs. It's such a low-lying branch for them, a low-lying fish, that it's not even on the radar. Now, here's the other thing. If you go back to the original story that we covered in episode 225, on February 3rd, 2017, you have to remember that Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, had filed the lawsuit against Charter and Time Warner, which again is a subsidiary of Charter, on behalf of the claimants within their state, within their district. Now, within the complaint, they were actually very specific on what they were going after. Specifically, they said that Time Warner Cable leased older generation single-channel D1 and D2 cable modems that weren't capable of delivering the speeds promised under contract. Now, consider what that means. It means that not only was the network not capable of delivering the speeds that they were selling, but they were leasing equipment to those customers that they knew weren't even technically feasible of getting those speeds. They also pointed out that TWC concealed the failure of these modems, which could deliver, again, only 20 megabits per second at best, by informing the FCC that all units would be replaced in 2013, which, of course, they weren't. This means that the FCC testing program, and this is the deceptive practices that is currently being brought out by the New York Attorney General, which measures services against their promised speeds, it didn't trip off any red flags, because if Time Warner Cable had replaced, as they said they would, all those modems in 2013, this wouldn't be an issue. But they didn't. They lied in their advertising. They lied in the FCC. And now, essentially what they're saying is, yeah, we lied, but, you know, in a couple of weeks, it probably doesn't matter that we lied. This is the issue I have, Lou, because this is an ISP who is now openly thumbing its nose and saying, what are you going to do about it? You know, the FCC is going to wash their hands of any culpability. They're going to say that they're not responsible for us. The FTC, we know they won't come after us. And by the way, we've preempted state rights, which means nobody can come after us. So, Lou, if the states can't go after them, and if the FCC is removing the responsibility for them, what do we have? What's our fallback?
I mean, if you're stuck in a zone where you can't, you don't have any other internet, I mean, you're kind of SOL. I mean, there's nothing else that you can do. But if you're in an area that, hey, I can change my internet, I'm not in a contract, then you have a little bit more power. But I think, you know, as a consumer, there's really not much you can do, unfortunately, until regime change happens and, you know, the thumbing becomes, puts a target on their back and, you know, things start to change. But as a consumer, there's, again, unless you're going to hit their pockets, there's really not much you can do.
Right, right. And there's one interesting thing. And the sad thing about this is the FCC should be answering this. Even though Pai wants to absolve himself and his agency of any responsibility over policing ISPs, there is language, even in the current bill, that states that states will continue to have their power to police these situations. So even the repeal of net neutrality has a little bit of that recognition, that head nod of, oh yeah, by the way, the states are the ones who are going to be experiencing this, so of course we're going to give them the right to approach the remedy. The fact that the FCC isn't pointing that out, and the fact that the FCC didn't correct charter in this filing, means that the FCC is willing to let even that tiny little legal protection fall to the wayside. Again, I mean, I don't know what more to do here. Oh, where do we go from this, Lou? I mean, seriously, I want to open this up because it is. I know it's tiring to talk about net neutrality over and over and over again, but you. I keep seeming to run into these people who think that nothing bad is going to happen when we already see the bad things that are happening.
So I think there's two things. One thing, you know, I like to call out the fact that the ASA, the Advertising Standards Authority in the UK, is setting regulation on May 23rd next year, saying you can no longer do this as an ISP. You can no longer you have to basically post your average settings, your average speeds, rather than your possible top speeds. So there's no longer, they're regulating that. That's obviously an agency that's regulating that from an advertising perspective. But from our perspective, what can happen? I think the first thing that needs to happen is a business needs to start to instrument their services, and ones that, you know, if things come back like paid lanes and so on, and big companies like Netflix can pay the bills, but small companies cannot, then those companies need to prove out liability and the fact that they're losing money and that they can't compete because of these types of things, and then put large lawsuits of losses against companies like Comcast and Charter. And by doing that, they're now getting open the door to those types of liabilities, because obviously being non-competitive in the United States is a pretty big thing. So I think I'm thinking that that's probably the next course of action here, that companies, once these things start happening again, holding these ISPs liable for losses and or monetary reasoning as a corporation, as a company, even as a small business, is where it's going to go next.
Right. Now, we've got Emily the Strange in the chat room, who asks a very good question. See, honestly wants to know, well, what does this actually have to do with net neutrality? I mean, because you've got one ISP who has been deceptive in their marketing and admin practices, why does that trigger anything within net neutrality? Well, it does, because in addition to bans on blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization, that was the foundation of net neutrality, specifically on the interconnects, not using interconnect agreements to slow down other services that otherwise should move quickly. The net neutrality rules specifically require ISPs to be transparent about their network management practices. Now, this is huge. It's not saying that they cannot practice network management. It says that anything that they do, they have to be open about. If they're going to throttle, they have to explain why they're throttling. And if it is a absolutely valid reason to throttle, then it would be allowed. Remember, the FCC was under Wheeler, was always about the light touch use of net neutrality. In other words, as long as you're providing good service to the customers that you are selling service to, we're not going to ding you. However, what the ISPs want, and this should be really clear in this case, is it's not that they're being harassed legally. They're used to that. It's that they are being asked to disclose what it is they are doing to manage their networks. They don't want to do that because a lot of really bad things happen. In fact, we're seeing it right now. And they're most upset at the fact that the New York AG has exposed something that, well, in any other business would be a fraud. If you are selling a level of service and you know you cannot provide that level of service, you lose your business. I'm kind of hoping the same thing happens here. All right, let's move on to another story. Unfortunately, it's also about net neutrality. Lou, now this is This is more nuanced. Okay, this is not good guy, bad guy. This is maybe a sign of the times, but we know that Comcast is already sneaking language out of its net neutrality pledges on its website. Now, this was huge. A couple of weeks ago, I got into it with a few fans of the show and then a few complete random strangers who were saying, wait a minute, no. Comcast supports net neutrality. They support all the tenets of net neutrality. So net neutrality must be bad because the corporations support it. Well, okay, that was a lie and that was a bluff. And now we know it because Comcast is slowly removing all of the promises it had on its website to uphold the claims of net neutrality. Now, they said that they would have no paid prioritization. They said that they would not throttle. They said that they would not create fast lanes. Strangely enough, those same websites are still up. Those same pages are there, but it no longer contains that language. Starting in 2014, the web pages of corporate Comcast contained a statement that says, Comcast does not prioritize internet traffic or create paid fast lanes. In fact, if you tweeted out to Comcast that your service was slow, you got that exact statement. That was a form letter, a form image that they sent out to everybody who was complaining about them on Twitter. Well, that's all now disappearing. Now that it seems imminent and practically unstoppable that Ajit Pai and the FCC are going to phase out net neutrality, Comcast and the other ISPs are starting to realize, well, you know what, maybe we shouldn't promise that because we have no intention on actually doing it. Lou, give me your take, and hopefully you're less cynical than I am.
So I think one thing to note is that these corporations, their revenue is, it can change at the drop of a hat. And so for them, every year it's just, upping their service fees. What I see is, small service fee creep with Comcast here and there, where my modem will go up 5 cents every month or something like that, and without me noticing, that kind of thing. But with in most cases it's customer ads, so they just they're hoping that more customers transition over. They'll offer deals and contract free and blah blah blah. But the truth of the matter is they're really trying to squeeze money. And so when it comes down to it, if it means that they need to start offering other ways, creative ways to make more money, this is going to be the way it is. And so by them kind of sneaking that language out, it's a little bit of a possible plan that they could have in the background. We don't know, for sure. But in the same sense, I wouldn't put it past any company to say, well, you know what, this is now our opportunity to add a revenue stream that we didn't have before. So maybe we should try to, ensure that we're not going to be held accountable for anything that we've claimed in the past. And so it could happen. It couldn't. But I wouldn't put it past a company that this is a special revenue stream for them.
Yeah. I think I could sum it up in this little story that I've heard circulating the webs. Now, Comcast, when they were pressed by a reporter to clarify exactly what they mean by this, by removing that language, Comcast said, well, there's a distinction between paid prioritization and anti-competitive paid prioritization. And they said, they're okay with paid prioritization, even though they previously said they weren't, but they would never do anything that was anti-competitive paid prioritization. So they were pushed even further by this press person saying, I don't understand. What's the difference? And Comcast said, well, anti-competitive paid prioritization would be something that would hurt competitors specifically because it's prioritized. And so the reporter very smartly said, okay, so let's do this. You're Comcast. You own NBC. Would you think that allowing for a zero rating of NBC streamed content faster than, say, Netflix would be an anti-competitive pay prioritization? And the Comcast representative said, I don't think so. No, that's regular competition. So, folks, if you think that it's okay for Comcast to slow down its competitors, then congratulations, you're going to get your wishes. All right, we're going to have to move on because I do want to bring in our guest. It's time to talk a little bit about unified threat management, what it can do for you, and really maybe a new way for you to think about threats and how you deal with them. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, in today's day and age, there's an adage in the real world that continues years, decades, centuries after it first started, and that is Location, location, location. When you find that perfect location, when you find that perfect spot, that's how you expose yourself. That's how you grow your business. It doesn't matter if you've got the best business plan, the best product, the best service. If no one can find you, if you're not convenient, if you're not easily memorizable, then you might not exist at all. And guess what? That still holds on the internet. And that's why we're so happy to have Hover as a sponsor of the Twiat Riot. Now, this episode of Twiat is brought to you by Hover. They want to know, what are you passionate about? Do you have an idea for a business? Are you launching a creative project? Are you buying a domain name that will show who you are? Because that's the first and the biggest step in building your brand online. Hover has over 400 domain extensions to choose from to help you brand yourself. That's a lot of choices to help you find the perfect domain name. If you're a blogger or, say, a company trying to create a new lead or inform your customer base, you can use .blog instead of a generic .com or .biz domain name. Now, by using .blog, you're telling everyone to expect impactful content about your topic or business rather than a generic homepage. Again, location, location, location. Whatever your interest might be, Hover has an extension for you. That includes things like .tech, .photo, .security. And do you know what else is great about Hover? The fact that they have best-in-class customer support and no upsells. The Hover Connect feature allows you to connect your domain name to any host or website builder with a few simple clicks. They're not trying to lock you in. They're not trying to overcharge you. You even get personalized email that matches your domain and further supports your online identity. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to present your best side to the internet. Show the online community who you are and what you're passionate about. Just go to hover.com/twit and get 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com/twit. And we thank Hover for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We now get to do my favorite part of the show, and that's when we welcome a guest into the Twiat Riot who can drop knowledge on our audience. And today we welcome Mr. Andrew Bagrin. He is the CEO of OmniNet. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us here on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we know that you are a security expert. You spent pretty much your entire professional life doing this. But what is OmniNet? For the folks playing along at home, how would you describe OmniNet in an elevator pitch?
Sure. That's a great question. So OmniNet is a very new way to look at security, specifically perimeter security. That's where this unified threat management comes in. It started as a firewall, and most people today know what a firewall is, or at least have heard of a firewall. So OmniNet, it really changed the way you deploy this firewall or deploy unified threat management. Traditionally, it's deployed as a box at the customer location. And you stick it into the network, and it kind of serves as a router and also has a lot of inspection. And that worked great. But as time went on, there's a lot of new threats, and the amount of threats grew quite a bit. So the amount of inspection that needed to happen on this box grew exponentially. And that created a lot of problems, specifically around slowness and complexity. So what OmniNet does is it fixes those by changing the place of where that inspection happens. Instead of doing the inspection on a box at the customer's location, we moved all of the inspection to the cloud, where we have literally unlimited processing resources. And now we can scan for everything. We can look for all the threats. And we can block them at a very, very good performance rate.
Andrew, you founded OmniNet in 2013 after working with both Fortinet and with Checkpoint Security. So you have a pedigree in this. This is what you do. But like you, I remember the time, especially when I was still working with the InteropNet, where security was, as you said, was a box. It went at the top of the rack, and it made sure that our network was separate from everything else, that we were protected, that the services that needed to be offered were being offered without opening up any security holes. However, as you've mentioned, especially in 2013, we started to see those boxes move upstream. So they moved from the client location to, say, the colo that gave them their connectivity. And with you and with OmniNet, it's moved one more step up to the cloud. Tell me, what are the advantages? What are the inherent advantages of having that protection upstream in the cloud rather than having it at the delineation of my campus?
Sure. So the biggest advantage is this is, if you're a large corporation and you have 50,000 users at a campus, No problem. It's almost as if you are a data center. But the smaller you get in size of business, then you can't afford to have these expensive $100,000 firewalls. And you get with what you can. There's this problem that I call the cybersecurity trichotomy, and actually have a picture of it on slide 7 there. You have security, you have performance, and then you have cost. And it's pick two. You can't have all three of them. And because what happens is as soon as you want to start saving cost, you can either suffer on performance or security. And in our world of small, medium businesses, you know, cost is the most important thing because that's what hits my pocketbook today. Performance is the second most important thing because I experience it right now. And security is the thing that suffers. And you can't solve that problem by having that box, having that inspection on-prem there. And this is kind of where this whole attitude changes and everything changes. And we didn't invent this architecture. We really, you mentioned I was at Checkpoint, then at Fortinet. We really helped telcos deploy this architecture before in the enterprise setting. But we saw the value of this is whenever you go down market to the small, medium businesses, we saw the value that this brings in a big way. And that's why we launched the platform specifically focused around the small and medium businesses.
We've got a question from Emily the Strange in the chat room. And actually, this is one that I get a lot. You know, she wants to know, well, doesn't this slow it down? I mean, if you're doing firewall as a service, doesn't it mean that all your traffic has to go through that firewall service? Wouldn't that slow your throughput? I mean, it doesn't, but can you explain why it doesn't?
Without getting too technical. So it goes back to, I was listening to the whole net neutrality thing. And we ran into a lot of problems. You mentioned Time Warner, and that was actually one of our bigger problem ISPs. But whenever we started doing this, we found that internet broadband is actually really horrible, and it's never what it says it is. And this is kind of where we enhanced our service with OmniNet, with OmniWAN, and providing the software-defined WAN, which I'll get into a little bit more. But just to kind of get back to that point of it doesn't actually slow it down, we actually see an increase in performance. A lot of times it's very significant because if you're already doing that inspection on-prem, that's one point of slowing it down. But also if you're just talking about straight network latency, we have 6 data centers in the U.S., and those data centers are strategically positioned to be geographically close to wherever you are. And for instance, we're talking right now, and this is a live interactive stream, wherever I am, wherever you are. So that our points, we can't make them any closer than they are. The one thing is though, depending how our ISPs are peered, they could be peered directly, they could be peered through a third party. The internet will route that traffic based on whatever those ISPs decide they want to do. And sometimes it's not the most efficient route, and it goes somewhere who knows where. But because we take and we route that traffic to the closest data center wherever we are first, that's your first hop. And then though that data center is oftentimes peered with thousands of ISPs. And then from there, we route it to the destination. So now it takes the shortest geographic route as opposed to being routed around however the ISPs decide to route you.
Right. Yeah. This is actually a common misperception that we received all the time. And we were able to show them with the InteropNet exactly why it was better to block upstream. Because if we allow that traffic to come down our connection, which was pretty decent back then, we had a dual gigabit Ethernet connection. This was back in 2007. If you just allow it to be unprotected, we would get at least 20% to 30% of that bandwidth just being taken up by scans, just by port scans, and blocking it upstream means that that's noise that's no longer on our line. But let me ask you this: there are people who will confuse firewall as a service with firewall in a colo, because the intermediate step was to move the firewall from campus to the colo at the ISP. You are going even one step further. It's no longer at the ISP. It's a service. It's a service that does unified threat protection across multiple clients. How does that differ from me just having my own box upstream?
Yeah, that's a great question. So here's the big difference. If you have your own box upstream, you still have this box and you're at the mercy of the performance of this box. If it's as a service, you know, we have tons of cores, that high-end cores that are the processing is shared across thousands of customers. So you're able to spike up your bandwidth as high as you need to, the inspection as high as you need to, without suffering in performance at all. And whenever you're not using the, you know, those cores for the processing, then other customers are using them. So there's this kind of like a shared processing resource that allows you to spike up as high as you need to spike up without suffering at all in the bandwidth. And that kind of goes into the next thing of, what are you inspecting for? So a lot of times whenever you start getting into the smaller boxes, a lot of the security is removed, and it is quite a bit of it that is removed. We don't think about it. And just think about simple things like, if you have a smaller UTM, oftentimes they don't even allow you to change the file scan size for antivirus. Oftentimes the default is 10 megabit. Well, why is that important? Because if they don't allow you to change the default from 10 megabit, and I'm a hacker and I'm writing malware, every malware I write is going to be 11 megabit because I know I just bypassed a bunch of these smaller firewalls. And there is another 1,000 examples exactly like that. Why it's beneficial to have it as a service, to have it properly set up, to have it where it's high performance.
Okay. I think most of our audience is savvy enough, and they've heard us talk about this topic enough that they understand the advantages of having something like this. If I have something that's not just a box, but is a service, it means at the bare minimum, I am benefiting from all the experience that that service gets from all of its clients. So even if I'm not attacked by something, if another customer of that service is attacked by something, they know how to defend me against. I'm assuming that OmniNet does that, right? I mean, you do the sort of blanket protection. You attack one of our customers, we protect all of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, just recently we launched sandboxing for smaller businesses. It's kind of one of these things that's almost impossible to get because it's pretty high end tech. And the way sandboxing works is it's a 0-day discovery for malware. And out of the tens of thousands of users out there on OmniNet, if one of them downloads a 0-day, it gets sent into the sandbox. And then that sandbox goes, whoa, this is malware, this is malicious. Instantly, the other 100,000 users are instantly protected from that same virus. It's no longer a 0-day on our network. So that's the big benefit that you have.
And we've got a practical question about that big benefit from JJ to the 4884 in our chat room, who just wants to know, okay, that's good. He understands that. But how fast can you update the rules? So when you detect something that's new and anomalous, how quickly can you turn that around into protection?
It's usually less than a minute. Most is going to be about 2 minutes. Yeah.
Oh, well, wow. Did not expect that. That's fantastic. So wait, how big is your engineering department and what kind of warning, what kind of screen do they get when a new anomaly is detected?
So there's different ways to do this. So we subscribe to a lot of threat intelligence, which we get from various sources. But in this case, what happens is whenever this file is considered to be malicious in the sandbox, because it runs in VMs and it detects what it does, then there is a hash created of this file. And the hash gets sent out to all of our protection points instantly, automatically. And now any file that comes through, it checks for the hash and sees, okay, this hash. Okay, this is the same file that we already know is malicious, and it blocks it.
All right. Now, I have to ask this because, again, our audience is pretty savvy and they know the advantages of having something as a service because, again, I'm benefiting from the experience across the platform. However, I have to ask the corollary, and what are the disadvantages of using this as a service? Because, I mean, I'm now trusting that OmniNet is going to protect me against everything that I need to protect myself against. Is it a thing for clients to have OmniNet and still run some sort of local protection, some sort of local firewall?
It's not very common. Some of them do that exact same thing. It's usually when they want more features, something a little more robust, that they'll run something locally as well, and they'll just use us as that high level in the cloud scraper of all the extra garbage. But typically, the market that we service, it's enough features. It provides them everything they need. That's one of the drawbacks that I would say as having it as a service is you could go out there and customize and build something that's going to be a lot more feature rich, and you'll be able to accomplish more things. But with features, feature rich, with all the extra stuff comes complexity, and comes when security, complexity means that it becomes less secure because it leaves the door open for mistakes as well.
Right. All right. Now, one of the things that a cloud-based firewall as a service solution is going to allow us is for unified policy. And that's what it's really, really good at. The ability to set in one place and then have policy be distributed across my entire network, all my nodes, all my remote branches, et cetera, et cetera. But another part of that, hopefully, is unified authentication. Is OmniNet moving towards that? I mean, you're already going to provide me my security solution. It seems like a natural fit for OmniNet at some point to offer some sort of universal authentication that takes advantage of firewall as a service, no matter where in my network it might be.
So currently, we do not play in that space. We do not play in the authentication space. That is something definitely that makes sense, as you said, because you now have a unified perimeter, a unified protection. Another step would be the authentication. Currently, we just try to integrate with other authentication pieces, but we haven't gone down that route yet to provide that part as a service.
Okay. That works for me. All right. Now, if someone was looking at this, if someone was looking at presenting this to their C-suite executives, who, as both Emily the Strange and JJ the 4884 in our chat room are pointing out, is difficult at times because security is still one of these things that executives will only pay for when there's a big story. So we just had the Equifax breach, and yes, there's a bit of a rise in security expenditure, but overall, once the buzz goes away, nobody wants to spend money on security. Nobody wants to spend money on firewalls. Nobody wants to spend money on things that they don't really understand. What is the elevator pitch that you would give to those IT folk who can then pitch their executives?
You know, that's a common problem, and that I've heard this for the last 20 years, and nobody wants to spend money on something that's not affecting me today. And this is why we try to make it so easy, so affordable. It's there. We even have a cyber breach guarantee that if you get breached, then you're covered. It's backed by Assurant. But what we did also is we positioned this in the form of performance. So once we added SD-WAN into the picture, so SD-WAN is kind of one of these new buzzwords that everybody says they do, and you know everybody does it a little bit differently. But really, what we're doing is slide number 19 actually has a really good picture of this. But what we're doing is we're optimizing the performance of everything. So if you think about this, over the last 5 years, maybe more, all of the applications that you use, that your business relies on. So your business kind of runs on all of this technology. And all of this technology, it relies on your network. Now, it used to be your local area network because that's where all your applications were. But now all of these applications move to the cloud. So now you're relying on your internet connectivity. And how good is that? And we heard already about this net neutrality thing where all these ISPs are lying about what they're giving you. They're, you know, sure, you have, they're giving you 200 meg, but that's with 30% packet loss, you know, and different times is different things and everything. And even sometimes the equipment doesn't hold up to whatever the bandwidth says it has. And we saw all of this stuff, right? So what we do is, number one, is we clean the line from the cloud, make sure it's clean. And number two is we optimize all the traffic. So on the left side there, you see here's a typical ISP. A lot of the stuff coming across that line is garbage. There's bots, there's threats, there's advertising, there's scanners, there's hacking tools, probes, everything else. The statistic that I saw out there is 48% of all the traffic is non-human, which is it's all bots. Some of it's good bots like Googlebot. Some of it is bad bots. A lot of it's bad bots like hacking tools. Well, if that's flooding your pipe, you know, what's left for you to use? And step two is once you clean it, then you optimize the traffic. So what we do is if you only have one ISP, we figure out where is the breaking point, right? Sure, your ISP might say that you have 200 meg, but where does it really start to fall off the map? Where does it start to get high latency, a lot of jitter, and where do you start getting packet loss? And once we figure that breaking point, we actually put what we call dynamic guardrails, which sits there and tests it and makes sure that if it needs to adjust, it will. But this is what is the known good. And out of 200 meg, it could be only 110 meg,
right
that you get of clean bandwidth. And then from there, we take and we go, okay, we know we have 110 meg of clean bandwidth. Now let's take all the priority queues and prioritize all the traffic accordingly so that your daily backup or your Dropbox sync is not overriding your voice conversation or your WebEx that you're doing.
I mean, that's always been kind of the holy grail of SD-WAN. I mean, that's real-time QoS that I can just have a bunch of rules for.
Right, exactly. And because we do security and SD-WAN together, we do it automatically. we identify over 6,000 applications, and that automatically feeds into the SD-WAN and prioritizes the things that need to be prioritized. I mean, we even prioritize that, you know, Skype voice versus Skype file transfer and in the 6,000 other ones, you know, and put them all in the proper classes. And if you have two lines, like I have at my home office here, I have two different ISPs, it'll actually take and test each one and say, okay, this one's better suited for voice, this one's better suited for data transfer or file streaming, and it'll actually separate out the applications and use the line that's best suited for each application.
Right, right. Well, I want to bring my co-host into this before we run out of time, because he's been, I have him in my preview monitor, he's been sort of bouncing around. I think he's kind of buzzing. Lou, you had some questions about the barrier to entry and how this is going to work in a typical network.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that, you know, we hear a lot is, you know, making it easy, the kind of barrier entry for the small mom and pop stores all the way up to the medium sized to large businesses. You know, what does it take to get started? Obviously, they come, they check it out, they sign up for your service, but do they have to make changes to their hardware, to their appliances? You know, what do they actually have to go and do in order to kind of get started and using your services?
Yeah, so we have appliances. We have small, medium, and large, and small ones pretty inexpensive. Literally, you plug it in, it phones home. If you have two ISPs, you plug it into both, it phones home across both. We run this one-time optimization that checks the line, and it puts all the performance parameters around it. And from there, you're pretty much ready to go. The security, we simplified it so much. It's if you say, I'm a retail store, then you could just have simple checkboxes, sliders, categories that you select. But typically for a retail store, we have specific settings that we put around there to make sure they're PCI compliant and make sure they have all the proper security settings from a unified threat management perspective. And that's all done automatically underneath the covers through our management system. They have the management UI that makes it very easy for them to do all of that stuff.
Cool. One other question. So it sounds like it's as easy as if you're like getting a cable modem or something. But how do businesses really determine, you know, you said they're small, medium, or large. How do they determine which one they need? Is there something that gets measured? Do they have to say, hey, I think I'm going to have more traffic than not? You know, how do you kind of gauge that for them?
So there's a few things we ask. If it's only one ISP and not multiple ISPs, that's the first question. The second question is, you know, what's the bandwidth on it? And if it's 150 megs or less, that's what we consider a small. And the third one is how many internal networks do you have, or how many VLANs do you have? And that's the third question. So that pretty much determines what they need to have from our perspective. It's very simple, very easy, and it starts a very, very low price to kind of get into it and to enter into the market.
Let me jump in here, because there's a question that's been sort of brewing in the back of my head, and that is, at several of our larger networks, there's always that one guy, the firewall guru, the guy who knows routing, he knows everything, he's the one who touches the external facing hardware. Now, will we still need someone like that in our network? I mean, if we go with firewall as a service, and if we trust our service like OmniNet, it seems like that's not local knowledge I need to keep on my campus any longer.
So this is the interesting part. I worked a lot with what's called MSSPs, Managed Security Service Providers, some of the top ones out there, to help them set these services. And that's where you hand over the complete controls to one of these organizations. They're very good. They're very expensive, but that's what they do. So what we did that's different is we're kind of this hybrid platform where our engineers take care of the very tough, difficult stuff underneath the covers, but still give you a good amount of controls to be able to do things on your own. Do you need the guy? You could still use him and leverage him, but really to set up all of your security, you don't need that really high-end engineer. You need like a level one, level two tech that could take care of it without any problems.
Now, I'm just thinking a very specific couple of cases where we had the security guru who clearly knew what he was doing and clearly knew how to set things up, like broadcasting routes, but never wanted to explain what he was doing and was completely uninterested in trying to teach others to do it. This could be one of those ways to sort of say, yeah, we want this knowledge, but we want this knowledge that is shareable. And if I can bring in a firewall as a service and provide the same thing that you're doing right now, it kind of gives you incentive to cooperate with the team. Okay, but that's my mini rant. Not even going to go into that. All right. In your experience, as you've deployed your service to more and more enterprises, what is the biggest sticking spot? The people listening to you right now, the people who are considering maybe moving to a firewall as a service to get all the efficiencies that we've already talked about, what's the number one thing that you've seen over and over again that tells you either they're not ready to move to firewall as a service or maybe that they don't need firewall as a service?
Really, it's the size of the organization. If you, they said they have that guy or the team of guys, and trust me, I used to be that guy in the 90s. I know exactly what you're talking about. But if they have a team of people or if they already have an MSSP that does it for them and they're very large, that's kind of, they're there and they're good where they are. Right. And they have all these features, all this integration and everything else. The smaller you get down in the scale of size of company, or maybe you have a lot of locations that it's impossible to have somebody on site to manage all this stuff. This is where it gets really interesting, very beneficial to have this firewall as a service, especially when it's coupled with SD-WAN.
Right. Okay. Now, if I were to be looking at this for our, we always use the mythical 10,000 seat enterprise example. So if I'm going to move it at 10,000 seat enterprise, which of course will include remote nodes, it will have remote branches, maybe two or three headquarters around the world. What are the challenges I will find in that particular case? I know how to do it. If I've got my own firewall appliances, if I've got my own colos, I understand how to connect branches. How do I do it through a firewall as a service?
So as far as connecting branches, it's pretty automatic. It happens very easily. You just say, hey, these are interconnected, and it automatically sets up a mesh. So it's, we call it like virtual MPLS. Oh, it sets up a wide area mesh, with the perimeter being out here, and the perimeter is spread across multiple data centers. The one challenge that you would have with us currently is we only service the US and Canada market. We have not gone overseas yet. So if you have offices that are somewhere overseas, they would have to be connected in a different way to us, or you'd have to route all their traffic through the US if you did that.
And what I really like about this presentation now is this has gone from a theoretical discussion just 3 years ago on Twyatt, where this is something that would be nice that if it could happen, to no, there's actually providers where I could buy this service from right now. Now, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but I do want to give you a little bit of time, completely free form at the end here, to address our audience. Tell them what are the things that you want them to walk away from this episode with. What are the things that they need to know when they start considering what their next network deployment is going to look like?
Sure. So, okay, think about this. We talked about net neutrality. If you have multiple ISPs or just one, and now the only thing the ISP sees is a tunnel going to our cloud, there's nothing to control or not control, right? You just eliminated that whole thing out of the equation. So I feel that SD-WAN is going to become a much bigger thing if the ISPs start trying to throttle bandwidth or take control or look at what you're doing or trying to sell your information of what you're doing. It's going to become a much bigger thing. It's definitely something to think about. Another thing to think about is just the level of security. Security is always getting more and more complex, and there's more things that need to be added everywhere. It's a hard thing to do. With a service like this, I gave the example, we recently added sandboxing. Right. So all of a sudden now everybody who's a customer of OmniNet has the benefit of sandboxing without doing a single thing. They just have it now. And then whenever something new comes out and there's going to be this new thing that you have to have this in order to be secure, we will just add it to our platform. It'll just be there as a service. It'll continue to protect our customers without them having to worry about, hey, what's this new thing? How does it work? How do I integrate into my environment? So that's a huge benefit. I think that's a very big thing to think about. I think as all of the IT providers out there that are servicing their customers, they need to think about this. So I saw actually today an email. I saw that managed security services or security in general is a $1 trillion industry for the next, I think it was 4 or 5 years. $1 trillion and a big chunk of it, I think it was 28%, was for managed security services. Now, if you're managing IT for businesses currently today, you really need to start managing their security. And there's no easier way to do this really, really well than with OmniNet. It's simple, it's easy, it gets you started. There's no huge upfront cost to get you started. And it works extremely well. We have a lot of great testimonials about even partners who said, hey, before I used to be in an office at least twice a week doing cleanup of viruses, ransomware. And in the last year, I haven't had a single infection. It just speaks for itself of how well it works.
I like that. And that's really sort of the promise, has always been the promise of any as a service or SD-WAN. We have been speaking with Andrew Bagrin. He is the CEO and founder of OmniNet, a provider of firewall as a service and software-defined wide area network technologies. I want to thank you for sharing your time and your wisdom with the Twiat Riot. That's the audience for This Week in Enterprise Tech. If you could please tell the folks where they can find you, where they can find your work, and of course, where they can find OmniNet.
Sure. So OmniNet.io, that's our website. The Twitter handle is on my lower third there. It's OmniNet Inc. My personal Twitter handle is A. Bagrin, and the last name Bagrin is so uncommon that anything A. Bagrin is usually me. And in fact, probably 10 years ago when you Googled Bagrin, I would be the only person that came up in the entire all Google pages. That's how uncommon it is. Very easy to find. OmniNet.io should point you in all the right places. Our YouTube channel, Facebook, everything else.
Andrew, thank you very much for sharing your time with us. And, of course, for sharing really good information about the future of UTM and firewall as a service. Again, we thank you for being on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 people as a service. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible, of course, to our guest, and of course to Lisa and Leo for letting us do this show for so long, but also to my co-host, Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, it is always a pleasure. It's always so much fun just to get together with friends and geek out. Where can people find you, your work, and will you be moving buildings again soon?
Well, I love doing the show, so thank you for having me on. You can always find me. I'm not moving buildings anytime soon. I'm hoping that. But you can always find me at Twitter at LouMM. And of course, all of my work that I do here at Microsoft is stemming from dev.office.com.
Fantastic. And when I do come up to Redmond, can we do a show from a treehouse?
We could sure try.
I know they don't have power, but they've got Wi-Fi, so that should work.
That's right.
Of course, also thanks to you. To the people who log in every week to watch this show. Without you, we wouldn't have an audience. Without an audience, we wouldn't have a show. I want to make it easy for you to get all of the enterprise goodness that you want each and every single week. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. That's TWIET, This Week in Enterprise Tech. There you will find all of our back episodes as well as the show notes for every episode. If you want to find out more about a story that we talked about, if you want to find out more about net neutrality, if you want to get the contact information for our guest, you're going to find it there. Again, twit.tv/Twiat. Of course, while you're there, why not subscribe? It's the best way to support Twiat. If you want to continue to see this high-quality content, just get the version of choice, video, audio, or high-definition video, into your device of choice. Again, twit.tv/Twiat. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you'll find out what I'm doing when I'm not here at the studio, as well as what I'm building like this. I'm currently working on a ZPM from Stargate Atlantis. Now, that little 3D printed thing actually has a bunch of electronics inside that will allow it to glow, and it's going to charge off of a little cradle. And hopefully by the end of the project, I'm going to send a finished version to David Hewitt, and it's going to be kind of awesome. Also, thanks to everyone here in the studio who makes this show possible, to Alex, to Burke, to John, our engineers, who make sure everything is plugged in correctly and pointed in the right direction, and yes, to RTD, Kevin, the Shark Boy. Kevin, how are you doing back there?
I'm sore.
Kevin is very sore. Now, Kevin, this is the end of the show. This is the time when we offer you a chance at redemption for all of your missed answers. I try to ask you something from the show. So how about this? Let's go super, super simple. What does SD-WAN stand for?
Standard definition WAN. Standard definition WAN.
Oh, that's so close, Kevin. It's so close, but no. No cigar. Maybe again next week.
What is it?
No. Software-defined wide area network.
It's not super deformed?
It could be. It's, you know, who knows? It's just words. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you, that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.